no quorum this month for JEA as the whole board is told to step down. The first lawsuit is filed in the El Faro tragedy, and a beloved gathering place at the beaches closes its doors. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Well, good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9, and now catch the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. Then later, a major announcement bringing world-class cancer care to town, courtesy of Baptist Health. Plus, helping the homeless of the First Coast get back on their feet. We'll tell you about a brand new facility, the Sulzbacher Village. All of that ahead, but first it's Friday, and our weekly roundtable is here today. Andrew Pantazzi of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Fred Matthews, who writes for The Examiner, with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Matt Shaw, editor at Folio Weekly.
Hi, Melissa.
Guys, great to see you. Plenty of news from the week to talk about, from a $100 million lawsuit filed in the El Faro sinking to demands for more oversight into federally subsidized public housing in the city and more. But we want to begin with our top story first this morning. JEA, our public utility, will not have a quorum for its regularly scheduled monthly board meeting coming up on October 20th. That's because Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry has asked for the resignations of all JEA board members. And this week, two more of them have resigned, Board Chair Helen Albee and also member Wyman Winbush. Meanwhile, earlier this week, there was some drama at the Jacksonville City Council meeting when a large group showed up to protest Mayor Curry's move to remove some members of the city's Planning Commission from that independent board. We begin the hour with a look at this top story. Let us know your thoughts about Mayor Curry asking the entire JEA board to step down. What do you think? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Fred Matthews, this all began with a story in the Times Union, and Andrew, we'll ask you about this as well, of course, letting people know that the board was given scripted talking points in advance of their meetings. This raised some concerns about the Sunshine Law. What do you think about the mayor now saying, I just want to get rid of the whole board, and he's asked for everyone to resign?
Well, it goes to the question of independence of the boards. If the mayor can just walk in and do this anytime, then why don't you just make it a commission and not a board and have it all under the mayor's department, and we'd be done with this. This is the same debate, you know, we've had this here at the roundtable for some time about the independence of these authorities. And the JEA is one of the most important authorities we have in this city because all of us are connected to it in one way or the other. The question at the bottom of this still comes down to why is the mayor so bent on getting this done? Why these resignations? Why having to have them to submit the resignation to him as if they are members of his staff and not appointed independent citizens who are not on salary?
Well, Fred, I'll answer that. So the reason why this is happening is because JEA operates a $2 billion public utility. And the way they've operated it in recent years, the Florida Times Union has shown in Nate Monroe's reports, they have never disagreed, had a dissenting vote in their board meetings. Every single time it's been a unanimous vote since like 2013. They have scripted comments. What we showed was they emailed out, here's exactly what you're going to say when we approve the bonus or incentive pay of the head CEO of JEA. Here's exactly what you're going to say. And under Florida open meeting laws, you're supposed to not talk to one another unless you're at a meeting. You're not supposed to relay comments to one another. And if you're giving scripted comments saying, here's exactly what you need to say, then you're not allowing for an open dialogue to happen in the public eye. And so the mayor has said that this does not jive with the city of Jacksonville's mission. So I'm asking for the resignation of all board members, and we're going to clean house. And now we don't have enough members left for a quorum.
And who sent out the memo? Who sent out the memo?
You mean from City Hall?
No, from JEA. Was it sent out by the chairman of the board? Was it sent out by the CEO who's hired by the board? Who sent out the memo? In most nonprofit corporations, this is, as most many folks know, this is not terribly unusual to have the agenda sent out. Here's what we're going to do. The school board does it all the time. The question is, and I'm not disagreeing that this was improper, but the question still comes down to the same thing. When you get to the board meeting, you don't have to go by the script that somebody sends you or says this is the agenda. You still have the ability to amend the agenda and all that sort of thing that's done all the time in meetings. Who sent out the script? Who said this is what we're going to do? And who and was the agenda approved once it got there? I assume that it was, but who sent out the
agenda?
Well,
let's bring in Matt Shaw. Let me pose this as another question. The issue has been raised as to whether JEA has skirted the Sunshine Law. The issue has also been raised as to whether the mayor is overreaching his executive authority in calling for these sweeping removals of members of independent commissions and boards. Matt Shaw.
Sure. I think, first of all, as I understand it, the mayor's general counsel, said that there was no Sunshine Laws violated in these scripted talking points, but he did make recommendations for moving forward and what not to do in the future. So to that point, they have recommendations for what to do moving on, but as far as Mayor Curry overreaching, I think we've talked about it for a few weeks now, just with the City Planning Commission moves, just the fact that he's expending a lot of political capital here on these moves, and it may be unnecessary. And we saw at the City Council meeting the other evening on Tuesday night, just during the public comment session, how many people came out against this move to
Let me ask you about that on Tuesday night, some unexpected drama, what's normally a pretty dry affair, the Jacksonville City Council meeting, as some folks showed up to show support for Planning Commission members Lisa King and Joey McKinnon, asked to submit their resignations to the mayor, neither of whom is saying they will do so. This puts the onus now, Andrew and Fred, on the city council. Will they buck the mayor, or will they support these planning commission members who are defying the mayor and saying, no, I won't resign?
Well, I mean, I think they have to support the mayor. I mean, they have to support their mayor. He's made a determination that this is his vision. He's coming in with it. At least 90% of the council are supporters of the mayor, and I don't see how they have any choice but to support what the mayor wants and see what happens in a year. These are appointees, after all. They don't have any political clout. Lisa King doesn't have any political clout. She's got to lobby the council to get her seats, and the mayor has the upper hand on that. So I don't see any light.
Well, Fred, I guess I don't understand the difference here, though. JEA board members are appointees of the mayor, mm-hmm. and they also serve at the discretion of the mayor in the same way that the Planning Commission does. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference here between the JEA board members that he's asked for the resignations from?
Well, there's really not that much difference, except for the fact that the mayor has, they all serve, those who are appointed through the mayor's office, serve at the pleasure of the mayor. We have here an extended staff. Now, we have the illusion that this is independence, Planning Commission, JEA, all of that. You have an illusion that they're independent, but the reality of it is that they're not. And this blatant action by the mayor shows that they're not independent of that. Because once he appoints these, and they're his people, and it's just as easy for his chief of staff to call over to the JEA and say, look, I don't want this. The mayor doesn't like this. You got to stop doing this, the other thing. He doesn't have to talk to them. And that's what we're dealing with. It's not independence here. And that's the argument, is that he's tearing away the veneer of independence here. I'm not saying that they're right.
Matt.
I think traditionally a lot of people look at these commissions and city council, the planning commissions and the zoning commissions as sort of checks and balances on the things that are happening in the mayor's office. And when you have a mayor who got elected with, was it 56% of the vote? I mean, it wasn't a wide margin. And then he's going to put only people who agree with his vision for the city, and not people who may, even though they have experience, like in the case of Lisa King, who is a respected member of that planning commission, because she comes from a different political party or background, that he's going to remove her.
Andrew.
I do think they are different issues, because the planning commission and the other commissions are just they're more advisory commissions, whereas the JEA board, again, rules a $2 billion utility. I mean, that is a massive utility. And what you see here is, after the Florida Times Union's reports about, you know, Paul McElroy emailing someone with a headline that says talking points, and it says exactly word for word what he wants them to say when they approve his salary raise, the mayor emailed out, and I'm quoting him, "What the hell is going on?"
Well, why did the mayor talk to McElroy about it? He's the hired hand of the board that runs it. He's not the one in charge. The chairman of the board of JEA theoretically is in charge of the board. He's the one that determines the agenda from day to day. The CEO, just like any executive secretary of any corporation, nonprofit or profit, basically goes by that agenda, inputs it, and sends that out on behalf of the chairman
well,
of the
Fred,
board.
I think you may be mistaken here. I don't know if you've read all the stories, but he asked for meetings with all of the board members.
They objected because they didn't want to have meetings. And what they said was they didn't want to have shade meetings with him.
Yeah, but he said, "I want to talk to you. I want to talk about what's going on over there." People objected, and he has asked for the resignation.
So he has the meeting. So he's going to have a shade meeting about a shade meeting, and they object to have a shade meeting, so he's going to have them to step out. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
All right.
Some of them did meet with the mayor.
And some didn't.
And they're still asked to resign.
Right.
So.
Okay. Well, we're getting lots of tweets about this and calls, a couple of tweets from listeners. "We can predict what Curry and his team will try to do with JEA by looking at ALEC position papers on public pensions. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. The end game for Curry is to destroy the pension. It's predictable," tweets one listener. We'll talk about that in a minute. 549-2937, Lori on the West Side. Hi, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm going to tell you guys the who, when, where, what, and how.
All right.
Are very important questions. But for me, the glaring ones out there are the whys. And you're going to have to get that from the horse's mouth. I want to know why all this stuff is happening. And you got most of it covered, but you're going to have to go to the horse's mouth for the whys. But I am curious.
Do you mean why the scripting is happening or why the resignations?
Doing that? Why was it scripted? You got some of the who, when, where's. A lot of that information, but why is all of this happening? The mayor is not unaccountable, and he has to say why he's doing what he's doing.
Thanks, Lori. So there are two questions here. As Andrew pointed out, the initial questions came from why was the utility conducting the meetings in this manner? This seeming rubber stamp of the meetings, the bonuses and salary increases given to the CEO, that raised the initial eyebrow. That now the question seems to be, is there a deeper motivation or not for this wholesale sweeping asking of resignations? Fred?
Well, I mean, news stories often, it's very difficult to get to the why unless you can get someone to answer that, because then you get yourself into legal troubles. So the why is going to probably be left up to a lawyer or whoever is standing behind the lawyer to try to get to that. I don't think we're going to get to a good why other than we wanted a smooth meeting and we wanted to make sure that everybody was on point. But the question still has to be asked to the person who put out the scripted points.
Let me ask you, though, as a follow-up to Andrew's point, I think Andrew made a fair point in that when you have a public utility overseeing this much taxpayer money, it certainly is a legitimate story.
Sure.
When talking points are scripted, and there doesn't seem to be that the real meeting is the pre-meeting, as the TU reported.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be fair, the Times Union's Tia Mitchell has also reported that's the case for a number of boards and commissions and public agencies.
Yeah.
The real action takes place before the public meeting.
Yeah, I think ultimately when I look at the JEA board moves, I'm thinking a lot about A.G. Gankarski's piece about the city audit, the 90-day audit, and how broke the city is, and the contribution that JEA gives to the general pension fund to the city. And that has to be renegotiated. There is no money to do anything currently in the city budget for new projects. The city is, as AG put it, brisoke. And there's going to have to be some changes. And I think some of these motivations may lie in that fact.
And in the midst of all this, this week the Times Union reported with JEA that – so Paul McElroy goes to the board and he says, I need $3 million to study whether we need to demolish the JEA headquarters or whether we need to renovate it because we don't know which would be more cost effective. JEA says, why $3 million? He says it was an arbitrary number. Literally the words he uses, arbitrary. They reduce it to $1 million, give him the money for a study. And in the middle of the study, before it even comes out, he spends $400,000. That's $500,000 on renovations on an office for about 30 people. So, I mean, they're doing these financial things, and even the head of JEA is not telling the board what he's doing with the money. He did not inform them in the middle of those that study to see if they should renovate. He already was doing renovations with some of the money of the $2 billion public utility.
Let's go to Linda in Deerwood. Go ahead, Linda.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. I think this is part of the issue that I had with the election of Mayor Curry. It's not that he's not, you know, whatever, proficient, whatever. I was always concerned because he was coming. He always told us, I'm not a politician. But he's coming across like a Republican Party boss. I need my line people down. My concern, he is going to wipe out all these boards. He's going to put his people in. How do we know how they will be vetted? How do we know they'll be credentialed? Wouldn't that be perfect to replace all the boards, replace the CEO, and then raid the JEA fund? I mean, that would be a great way to plug up a deficit for the city, right? I just don't – everybody on Capitol Hill wants a study. I understand the Times Union came up with a great story. I just think that the mayor jumped way ahead to conclusions. Why not have an investigation? The newspaper only did a certain amount. Have a thorough investigation so that when he asked for this, it would look like he was making a deliberative call instead of just coming in, cleaning house. He hasn't told the public why he's doing this except to put his Republican Party cronies in to control the city. Thank you.
Linda, thanks. Well, the mayor has let's be fair. The mayor has said the reason he's doing this is because of the revelations involving how the board meetings were conducted. Let's go to Richard in Mandarin. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the scripts for the JEA board is just a symptom of the situation, the relationship between the city and the JEA. The JEA is essentially being paid by the city for lots of things. For one example, the situation with the St. John's River. The city has been tasked with cleaning up discharge into the St. John's, but the city has done nothing. So they're paying for pollution credits to the JEA. In the meantime, the JEA is the sole contractor for removing all the failing septic tanks around town. But there are no plans, zero plans with the Planning Commission to remove anything. So they're just basically going to keep getting money from the city, you know, forever. And they can't talk about this because it's a conflict of interest, so they have to stay on script. So that they discuss nothing, the money changes hands, and everybody's happy. So they screwed the pooch, they got caught, and the mayor's just taking everybody out.
Richard, thanks. Hank on the north side. Go ahead, Hank.
Yes, how y'all doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, I think the mayor is doing a pretty good job for the JEA. Me as a customer, being a JEA customer for a long time, I think myself is being overcharged, just like a lot of other people think they are. A lot of the JEA employees, technicians, they do a good job, but they get a lot of tremendous bonuses, which they should be getting. CEO getting high bonuses. So I think he needs to do what he needs to do to find out what's going on, where all this money is being generated to, where it's going, how it's spent. Customers are concerned about certain things for their electric bill and things. So
yeah.
I think what he's doing needs to go into effect.
Thanks, Hank. And getting some emails from folks saying that the script, you had asked about this, Fred, that the scripting of the talking points, according to an email from, I guess it's an employee, saying it comes from JEA Legal. We'll have to verify that, though. Harris in Mandarin. Go ahead, Harris. You're on the air. Okay, Harris, we lost you. Bobby on the north side. Hi, Bobby.
Good morning, y'all. I just wanted to make a connection here. You know, Curry helped get Rick Scott elected, and Rick Scott, you know, blames the previous administration, makes a lot of promises, and Curry does the same thing. This goes all the way back to the Delaney administration when they created the Jacksonville Port Authority. We've allowed these things to become monsters. I personally think the JEA is probably one of the best run in the country. When your lights go out, they fix them. When your water backs up, they fix it. You know, performance bonuses. Look, if you want to work out in the middle of the night and light and fixing power, you know, then complain to me about how bad JEA is. But Lenny is coming in here, and he's taken everybody out from the previous administration, and he's trying to blame the last guy in there. But he didn't create the problem. The problem's been around forever. You can go back to the pension board not being ever cited. In 2012, they asked him to, you know, sue. Nobody's done anything. Now we're here, we are 3 years later, you know, on our hands and knees begging Mr. King to give up his pension. He's not stupid enough to do that. We have to accept responsibility and accountability for what we do in this city.
All right. Thanks for that. A lot of interest in this story. How about that? The number to join us is 549-2937. And also making headlines this week, the first lawsuit has been filed in the El Faro tragedy. The family of a crew member of the lost cargo ship is suing the company that owned the El Faro for $100 million. Attorney Willie Gary, you might have heard that name once or twice, filed the lawsuit on behalf of Joanna Johnson, who will be the executor of the estate of Lonnie Jordan, one of the victims of the tragedy. Jordan was one of 33 people on board the El Faro as it sailed toward Puerto Rico 2 weeks ago. The ship disappeared somewhere near the Bahamas as it headed into Hurricane Joaquin, a matter that's now being investigated. Fred, no money will bring back this man or the others that passed away. Such a tragedy, and we're also learning that the El Faro had leaks, holes, other structural problems, and should not have been anywhere near that storm. It's such a sad, sad story.
It is sad, but, you know, once we get past that point, now the knives begin to come out, and compensation begins to be the topic of the day. It's just unfortunate. And everybody, I guess there were some bets being placed as who would be the first law firm out of the chute to get something done here. And lo and behold, we get Mr. Gary. So this is going to go on and on. It's going to be some years before this is settled. But it's going to come back to the company itself, and how are they going to financially be able to sustain any of these lawsuits?
That's right. Andrew and Matt, the entire merchant marine industry now is getting a very critical look in the wake of this tragedy.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, and I spoke to Senator Bill Nelson about this, one of the results of this is I think you'll have another look at the Jones Act, which, for those who aren't familiar, it's an act that says if you're sailing from an American port to an American port, as was the case with the El Faro, which was going to Puerto Rico, you must have an American-built ship with an American crew, and all repairs must be made by Americans. And what a lot of critics of the Jones Act say is that it means we have a fleet that is not as well-equipped as other nations, and that if we could get cheaper repairs from other countries, then maybe our ships would be in better shape. Others say if we do that, we will severely hurt our economy because then we lose a lot of jobs, and we're also not prepared in the case of an emergency to have a homegrown shipping industry.
Sure. Yeah. And those are both valid points. But when you look at the numbers, there's reports saying that the average age of ship built in the U.S. that is going port to port in the U.S. is 33 years old. And the average age of international ships is around 11 years old. So it's going to cause us to take another look at the Jones Act, and hopefully there's some compromises made over that.
Also making news this week, Congressman Andrew Crenshaw and Congresswoman Corrine Brown demanding action after federal inspectors say they found serious health and safety issues at the public housing complex Eureka Garden. This is a place that's had trouble for many years. Now, the place actually passed a HUD inspection just 2 months ago. Crenshaw says the feds need to stop nonprofits like Global Ministries from owning so many of these federally subsidized complexes. Tax records show Global Ministries had about $350 million in assets in 2013. Since December 2012, the federal government has paid the nonprofit $7.8 million for rent at just Eureka Garden alone, which is mind-boggling, Fred, when you see the condition of these apartments.
Well, I stay close to one of them, in fact, two of them, so I drive by them all the time and see see what's going on there. It's not, no one should be surprised that these apartment complexes passed inspection because nobody cares. And that's really the bottom line here. My gosh, there's gambling in there? How could this occur? I mean, this is a contract between a nonprofit corporation, but nonetheless, he's making a ton of money out of this deal. Yeah. A contract between this company and the federal government and a federal government agency, and they didn't take the time to do their job. It's unfortunately, you have to see the sad picture of this HUD field director schlepping around now with all these politicians all of a sudden having to explain herself on something that she probably knows very little about because they contracted all the work out for inspections.
Yeah.
You know, nobody watched anything about this, and because these people out here aren't paying that much for the money, who cares? So now we got this mess on our hand that makes us all look bad.
An interesting exercise is to get on the Google machine on the World Wide Web and look at Global Ministries Hamlet and look at some of the news stories coming out of Memphis. It's basically like a Mad Lib for the stories that are coming out of Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. Just insert, instead of Eureka Gardens, insert Goodwill Village or something like that. And it's the same thing. There's a mayor coming out who's appalled at these conditions.
Right, we had our mayor touring. Sure. Thanks to a local activist, we need to give credit, Denise Hunt
yep.
Basically begging the mayor to do this.
Sure.
And in the past, other mayors have done it too.
Sure.
And here we are again. Andrew.
Well, I guess so that, to meet Fred's point, so that people can care about what's going on, just to give you some background on Eureka Garden, this is a place that's about two blocks west of Murray Hill on the west side of the city. It's got 400 apartment units. It's, you know, these red brick buildings that are scattered on this single site with fencing around it. And this is a style of housing where it's called multifamily single site. That means you've got lots of families living there. And the people who get the vouchers to live there, they're not able to move. So unlike Section 8 housing with the Jacksonville Housing Authority, where if you've got a bad landlord you don't like, you can go to another landlord as long as they're approved by JHA and the voucher will still work. With this site, if you live there, you're stuck there. And if you move, then you don't have a voucher. And so these people are more, in a sense, trapped in this area. And the nonprofit has what's called a housing assistance plan contract. Where they're paid, and they're supposed to be paid to help subsidize the housing. They're not paid 100% of the housing rent, but they're supposed to be paid the amount necessary to make the rent affordable. And so these families that are living there, when we say squalor, what we mean is there's mold in there, there's cockroaches, there's rodents, which I spoke to a Harvard public health expert last week who talked about how those things are likely to cause and aggravate asthma.
Yeah.
And what that means is you have kids who are more likely to miss school days.
Mm-hmm.
You have adults who are more likely to miss work days. You have people who are less likely to pay taxes because of that. And then as Garrett Dennis, the city councilman for the area, likes to point out, you know, this is an issue that affects all of Jacksonville because when an ambulance has to go there because there's a health problem, that's not just them paying for it. That's the city of Jacksonville losing an ambulance going there that could have been going somewhere else. And when police have to go there because of violence issues, that's the city of Jacksonville that has to pay. So this isn't just an isolated issue that if you care about affordable housing or if you care about the poor or the conditions they live in, this is something that everyone all over Jacksonville should be thinking about and should be reading about because it affects everyone no matter where you live in the city of Jacksonville.
Well, the question comes down to, though, are the given what we have seen preliminarily, The residents, if that were a private house, you're going to have to move out of that house to clear up the mold, to fix the ceiling, to put in the electric. Those folks are going to have to be moved out of those apartment complexes. The city of Jacksonville has given private contractors like this a model. It's called Blodgett Villas. For those who remember what Blodgett Homes looked like 30 years ago down there, and that was all cleaned out, shaved down, and put into the same with we have Brentwood Housing Complex, which people are crying to get into, a model of what public housing can be with people paying a portion of the rent. There is no excuse for what happened here, except that in the case of federal HUD, they obviously were looking the other way with a wink and a nod and allowing this to go on.
I have to completely agree about Blodgett Villas. If you ever get a chance to go over there, there and Durkeyville and Brentwood, and you look at what the Jacksonville Housing Authority did when it built new construction in the early 2000s and mid-2000s, these places are single sites, multifamily housing units, but they're also mixed use. So what they did is they added places like grocery stores into the site so that they had access to food.
Yeah, it makes a big difference.
They added health clinics.
Let's go to Lynn at the Beaches. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air. Lynn, are you there? Okay. Here you are. Lynn, are you there? Lynn, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm right here.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay, who am I speaking with?
It's Melissa. Go ahead, Lynn.
Yes, I'm speaking from the beach, and I'm referring to... Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Lynn.
Okay, what I'm calling in is regards to the agreement that the prior Mayor Brown signed for some folks out on the west side of the city, and they were supposed to be getting some clean water situation because they had no water that was drinkable or usable in any way.
Uh-huh.
And just where is the status on that? Because that was supposed to be taken care of some months ago.
Right. You know what? Unfortunately, I don't have that information at hand. Let me check on that for you, Lynn.
I will say that would be an issue with the JEA again.
That goes back to our top story. But thanks for the call, Lynn. And we are running a little tight on time, so finally, let's wrap up quickly with our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Only in Florida does a knife-wielding granny get collared by the cops after police say she not only came after her husband with the Ginsu knife, she also tried to hit him with her car. Police in Edgewater say 77-year-old Barbara Yedniak was in a rage after her husband Stephen confessed to being unfaithful to her some 40 years ago. Guys, let that be listen to you. I'm sorry.
Never forget.
Only in Florida do senior citizens get a DUI for blocking traffic with their motorized wheelchair. Police in Palm Bay say Ronnie Hicks strongly smelled of alcohol and refused to take a field sobriety test when they found him driving erratically in the wheelchair and blocking traffic on a bridge. The judge set a high bond in the DUI case, saying whether it's a motorized wheelchair or an automobile, the offense is the same. And finally, only in Florida does the man who pioneered the art of underwater photography move on to that great silver spring in the sky. Bruce Mozart, whose pioneering work helped make Florida's Silver Springs an international icon, died Wednesday. He would have been 99 in November. Mozart spent decades as the park's official photographer. His whimsical underwater images of bathing beauties earned him a place in photography's history books. He built an underwater camera made from sheet metal, soldering wire, plexiglass, and some nails and screws. This all began back in the 1930s, where they used to shoot the Tarzan movies in Silver Springs. Mm. He shot photos of all the stars of the area, like Gregory Peck, Jane Wyman, Lloyd Bridges, and more. R.I.P. to the famous George Mozart.
I learn something new every time I come on First Coast.
Oh, thanks, you guys. And thank you, Matt Shaw, Andrew Pantezzi, Fred
you,
Matthews.
Melissa.
Have a good weekend.
Join WJCT on Tuesday, October 27, 6:30 p.m. at the WJCT studios for a preview of The Chaplains, a film from Martin Doblmeyer that goes inside the dynamic and fast-changing world of chaplains, men and women who are trained to be of comfort and support to people of all faiths, or to those who profess no faith. After the preview, Martin will lead a discussion. The event is free and open to the public, but reservations are required. Log on to wjct.org/events to register.
Life has enough drama.
Seems we've gotten a bad batch of grits, and we think it comes from Minnesota. They've made everyone feel gloomy and guilty.
Oh, and reality.
Can we not do
all
this?
Right?
Can we
Listen,
just not do this?
I'm going to have a practice funeral. All right?
Find a way to forget your troubles.
With ping pong, trap shooting,
well,
hopscotch.
And gather some friends around the radio this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion returning Saturdays at 6.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, exciting medical news to share this morning. World-renowned cancer care is now available in Jacksonville with the opening of the Baptist MD Anderson Cancer Center. Now, this is the result of a powerful commitment of two organizations, both committed to deliver the most comprehensive and advanced cancer care available right here in our area. The MD Anderson Cancer Center is based in Houston. It is the largest freestanding cancer center in the world. Baptist Health and the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center are partnering up, and they're going to replicate that proven model of cancer care right here in North Florida. Here to tell us more, we welcome Baptist Health CEO Hugh Green here in studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also joining us, Dr. Ronald DePino, president of the MD Cancer Center. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Great to have you both. Hugh Green, let's begin with you. What an exciting partnership. How did this come about?
Well, it really is probably the most transformative thing we've done in clinical care. And as you know, Melissa, I've been here a number of years. But really, it was the recognition that, in my opinion, cancer care was rather disjointed, fragmented, often siloed. Therefore, creating a very difficult problem for patients and their families navigating the care. We really are, it's a game changer, turning that upside down to create a highly integrated, highly coordinated, patient-centric cancer care, replicating the model of MD Anderson in Houston, which is by far the leading cancer care in the world.
Dr. DePino, this is so exciting. Florida with the second highest new instances of cancer in the United States, second only to California. So this is a life-saving announcement for Jacksonville and Florida. For people who aren't familiar with this model, can you educate us about it?
Yes. Well, first of all, this is a tremendous positive event for patients here in this county. In fact, cancer is the number one cause of death. So it's a significant problem here in the region. And to join forces with such a quality organization committed to patients, committed to excellence, is a dream come true for us. Cancer is the most complicated diseases to diagnose and to treat. And essentially, it requires very sophisticated diagnostic procedures. You know, we see about 1 in 4 of the diagnoses that come to us from around the country to be incorrect up front. But also the treatment of cancer requires multidisciplinary care, where the collective wisdom of surgeons, oncologists, radiation therapists, nutritionists will converge on the patient. The patient is the center, as opposed to the patient going around to these different specialties one by one. So that concept of multidisciplinary care, where the collective wisdom of these different subspecialists come together, is the secret sauce that enables us to significantly increase the chances for survival and also improve the quality of life for our patients.
And so With all of that said, Hugh, this is a brand new facility that will be built right across the street from your main facility. That's exciting, too.
And we are right now operationalizing, unveiling the sign in our existing outpatient center where cancer care is done. We've renovated that facility. But this is the first step. And as you suggest, across the street, we'll be building a very significant physical building over the next couple of years, highly visible from 95, and it will have all cancer services under one roof to accommodate that multi-specialty and multidisciplinary work that Dr. DiPigno just described.
It's so exciting to see this sort of one-stop shop aspect of this because, as you say, Doctor, cancer devastates on so many levels, not just in terms of the physical aspect, but the psychological, how it affects the entire family. There are nutritional changes that people try to make in their lives. All sorts of, there is just a ripple effect that's so massive. And this center takes such a holistic approach to treatment. That's so exciting.
It is. And, you know, it's important to appreciate cancer is not simply a disease of the genes or affects a person. It really affects a family. And the family really provides the potential for an environment of healing. And so it's very important, given our patient-centric approach to cancer, that we really look at that holistic opportunity to really impact not just on surviving cancer, but preserving the quality of life and the family unit in a way that's really going to help the family to move forward.
How long had Baptist Health been working on this partnership? How long had this been on your radar?
Gosh, it's been well over a year, probably about 18 months. This is a very complicated partnership. And I say that not in the sense of any way being difficult, but some of the things that I've been challenged to try to correct in the community, that this is sort of a merging of logos. It's sort of a basically a name kind of thing we're just basically using almost a franchise kind of relationship. It's important to emphasize, Melissa, this is a 140-page agreement whereby we are literally replicating what's in Houston and Jacksonville. So it has taken time to put this together. It is still evolutionary, mm-hmm. and we'll see the continued growth and development because we are talking about cancer care from prevention and screening through diagnosis and treatment all the way to survivorship. This is, again, a very comprehensive approach to cancer care.
How did the model get developed in Houston?
Well, again, it's really having the patient as our North Star, thinking about what is in the best interest of the patient. So think about it. Oftentimes, when you have a diagnosis of cancer, it requires surgery, radiation therapy, chemotherapy, nutritional support, internal medicine support, psychological support, and so on. And we came to the view that in order for us to best serve the patient, we really had to bring those modalities together to the patient. In addition, because we see so many patients, we're able to sub-specialize. So when you go to see a surgeon or radiation oncologist, they may only see breast cancers. Our pathologists only diagnose breast cancers and so on. And this enables us to drive a very high level of accuracy and excellence. And we found that that concept is very exportable to institutions like Baptist that put patients at the center and are committed to clinical excellence. And, you know, to have magnet status, to be recognized as the region's preeminent delivery of care here was mm-hmm. clearly an opportunity for MD Anderson to further its mission and bring the world's best care to the region here where patients live.
And since your other two locations outside of Houston are in Phoenix and Camden, New Jersey, the Southeast, out of all the sites you could have chosen, choosing Baptist Health in Jacksonville is quite a feather in your cap, Hugh Green, and exciting for this region. I'm sure patients will come from far and wide for treatment.
Well, you know, I appreciate the comment about feather in a cap, but the most important thing is that we are very gratified that an organization of the caliber of MD Anderson has chosen to partner with us. But the most important thing, I have to emphasize this very strongly, it is the patients and their families who are going to be the beneficiaries. And that's what is common to the culture of both of these organizations.
It's exciting news, life-saving news for the First Coast. As Baptist Health and the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center partner for a new facility slated to open in 2018. CEO of Baptist Health, Hugh Green, joining us, and Dr. Ronald DePino, president of the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Gentlemen, thanks so much for sharing this news with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we're back in a moment.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
Hi, I'm Evan Willman. I typically listen to the station when I'm in my my home office. I work out of my house a lot. I have my HD radio in there. So this is really the best of all worlds. It gives me my news. It gives me music that constantly delights and surprises me.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
A few decades ago, Broadway looked a whole lot different.
Times Square was a dangerous, smutty place full of prostitutes and pimps, and no tourists, believe me, ever wanted to go to Times Square back then.
I'm Adrienne Hill. How Broadway became Broadway, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, exciting news for the Sulzbacher Center, Jacksonville's premier operation serving the homeless of this area, unveiling plans for a new community for women and children and families. It's called Sulzbacher Village, a brand new campus that will be located at West 44th and Pearl Streets, a place for families to put their lives back together. Sulzbacher President and CEO Cindy Funkhauser joining us now. And Cindy, you unveiled this exciting news last night at your Transformations event. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me, Melissa.
So good to have you. And so Sulzbacher Center, everybody knows, or most people know, is located right in downtown Jacksonville, has been for a long time. Mm-hmm. You're going to have now a satellite location, Sulzbacher Village.
Yes, Sulzbacher Village. We're so excited about that. There will be, it's a huge 75,000 square foot facility, and two-thirds of that facility is permanent housing, so that's something a little different for the Sulzbacher Center. But over the last 8 years, 8 to 10 years with the recession, families with children is the fastest growing segment of the homeless population, which I know you know. And at the Sulzbacher Center, on any given night, we have 360 people that live with us. And of that number, 200 are now women and children. And on any given night, we have anywhere between 40 and 120 families on the waiting list. So it's been a huge capacity issue for us. We've turned away 1,800 families over the last 5 years. And so we're very excited about the new village. Mm-hmm. And in addition to permanent housing, we're going to be serving female veterans. We'll have a female medical respite facility and a huge pediatric clinic that will serve the area, not just our children, but anybody. That's Health Zone 1. So that's a health desert over there. So we will have primary care, dental, and optical services for any children in that community.
This really brings home that the face of homelessness in this area isn't what people think it is. So often it's a woman with little kids.
That is true. And I know that most of your listeners do not know that there are over 2,100 homeless children in Duval County school system. And, you know, homeless families are the invisible homeless. They're not out on the street. They're not on the park bench. They're couch surfing, doubled and tripled up, about to be evicted or foreclosed on. So that a child, the face of a child is truly the face of homelessness, and people do not realize that.
So what's the timetable for this new campus outside the urban core? Mm-hmm. There's a campaign to raise money and get this going.
Yes, we've been in the quiet phase of a capital campaign for the last year and a half. And this is an $18.5 million project, which is a big, huge nut, which is very frightening at first.
That's a little bit of money. It's
very frightening. But at this point in time, Florida Housing Finance Corporation, we have gotten tax credits through the state and associated funding of about $11 million. We've raised about $5 million privately. So we still need $2.5 million. We're at that last 15%, so we need the community to step up and help us make this a reality.
Well, to learn more, just go to sulzbachervillage.org.
Thank you.
To donate, to learn more, to volunteer. She's President and CEO Cindy Funkhauser. A pleasure as always. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a program. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast, now up on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, a look at the week's top national news stories. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.